This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Gisella Kaplan joins us to talk about birds, as she likes to do. Gisella, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor.
Hey, Gisella.
Yes?
I understand you're not very pleased about them calling magpies dangerous birds.
I'm not pleased about any documentary that paints Australia in a light that all its wildlife is dangerous and to be avoided and so forth, because we have amongst the most unique wildlife, and that's not a good approach. You know, some of them, as some humans, may become dangerous, but certainly I would have thought we have the most benign, we are the most benign continent of all.
We have things that bite you, we have things that sting you, we have things like that, but generally most of those things only get aggressive when you provoke them.
Well, you see, I've spent some time in Africa and in South America and so forth, and I can tell you, you don't walk alone in the bush in any of those countries. Something very big can come your way, and that really can be very dangerous if it's the wrong day or the wrong mood.
Yeah.
Or in North America, if you try to trek alone and you encounter a bear that happens to have young in tow, well, that can be truly dangerous. But in Australia, you can wander about the bush. You just watch out for the few things that could bite you on the ground. But basically, you are very safe in the bush. And I've spent hours and days and weeks and months in the bush, never with a sense of fear. But I can tell you, it happens very quickly in Africa.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a dangerous... Are there any birds that you can consider actually to be dangerous?
Not to humans, notwithstanding Hitchcock's film. The birds, you know, it's just quite a psychodrama. Interesting, but it doesn't really happen. I mean, there are birds like skuas that are very, very big birds, and you walk along the peat marshes of Scotland or the Hebrides or the Orkneys, and if it has nesting time for skuas, they will not only dive bomb from a kilometre away, but they won't let you get away peacefully. So even if you turn around, they will pursue you, and they can do some serious damage. So these are extreme cases, but mostly birds are benign, and unless they are at risk from you in terms of their own safety, there is even in the larger birds no risk of attack.
We're talking about cassowaries earlier and the possibility that they can physically hurt you quite badly. But again, is that only when provoked as well?
Yes, when they feel their territory is invaded and somehow you're an invader. So if you talk loudly and walk towards it, that could definitely be regarded as an aggressive act. You know, but I've stood in front of cassowaries, wild cassowaries, and they've just looked at me and disappeared into the bush. So normally that doesn't happen, but of course they can be dangerous, and they live under a lot of stress. And but in most cases, these behaviours are self-defence.
Well, that's what I was going to say, but are they not only territorial, not only if they're defending young, are they just territorial about their area, that they have their area and they don't like people coming within it?
Well, not necessarily. It depends on whether you are an enemy or a competitor.
Mm.
And if you behave nicely, you see, what needs to be understood is that the birds and all animals can think and make assessments. And they make assessments about risk. And that sense of risk is heightened, of course, if they have their own young. And they need to decide whether this foreign thing that turns up in front of them is in any way a danger. And if you look at the risk, let's say, for the poor masked lapwings, or some people call them plovers, they are at constant risk, and the male is in a state of heightened stress. I mean, he's just about dying from the strain because the female is sitting on the ground, and there's very little that they have in terms of their own defences other than to keep making a big fuss that you ought to keep a safe distance from their nest.
Well, we have I've got a plover that has a go at me every time I go for a walk. Because it
Have you ever discovered the nest of the female?
No, because it's where I go for a walk. I have to walk down this path, and yeah. Which is next to the golf course, and there's a plover there that, I mean, it's fair enough, because obviously there's a reason for it. And he doesn't go very close to me, but he's definitely aggressive and swoops down. But he misses me by a good 2 to 3 feet. He doesn't get that close.
No, no, so that's a warning. And plovers don't sort of discriminate. I'm not even sure whether a plover would recognise individuals, individual humans. But generally you can say with plovers it's a circle of 10 metres around their nest.
Okay.
And if that gets invaded, and we tested that out in a primary school where they had called me in order to remove the plover, and I said, well, instead of teaching the children that birds and humans can't live together, how about we make a little flags, a cordon around it, and the children can see the progress. And in fact, a 10-meter cordon around the nest, they never attacked or went outside it, and the children were told to stay outside it, and they then saw the little plovers emerge, and they were all very excited.
So, what is it about humans, Gisella, that we need to change everything else's environment to suit us instead of us fitting in with other things' environments?
Well, ultimately, it's a matter of empathy. If you can think of what the life of the other might be like and the pressures they're under, that might immediately help to change the behaviour, you see, because what you're looking at is only a surface behaviour, and you're then judgmental instead of saying, why is this bird doing this? And perhaps I'm too close to its nest, and perhaps it is fearful, and perhaps it's stressed out, and perhaps it wonders whether I might be a danger to it. So, and the moment you've understood that point, the relationship changes completely. You know, with magpies, for instance, you can even negotiate that. I said, when you face them, and I said, well, do you think I'm too close? And I face the magpies, and when I know there's a nesting magpie, I tend to be a bit I'd play dirty. I bring a little bit of mincemeat. And I opened my hand and said, look, I've got this here for you, and I'm not an enemy. But the little bit of mincemeat becomes a symbol for my good intentions. And actually, the magpies stop and watch and assess. And they may not take the mince the first time, but they certainly don't swoop. So it because my behavior has decreased, in their eyes, has decreased the risk for them and their young.
You diplomat, you.
Pardon?
You're a diplomat.
Well, you see, and it works. It works like a charm. Now, it doesn't work like a charm, and lots of people who may have listened to this will say, well, you know, we've seen so many magpies swooping. In public areas, it is quite difficult for the magpie. Just imagine, they've got their territory, and the territory is an all-encompassing thing, and they have their nest site usually somewhere in the centre of that territory, and say, well, this is our safe spot, and we know the people who are around here and the other animals, and that's fine. We've sort of calculated in that risk. But if you're in a public place, they're constantly new people, and one of the important things about magpies is they recognize individual people. So if, let's say, the Smith family with 7 children lives in their backyard, they won't ever swoop them, because when they build the nest, they already knew they were there and they're known, and they have assessed the risk before they built the nest. So they said, no, they're okay. They seem so-and-so doesn't seem too much of a lout, and so-and-so wasn't the
unless they are.
And therefore, it's relatively safe for us to build a nest here. But if then other people come in, they have never seen before, and they walk through without even asking and without taking any note of their concerns, then they have to warn them. And almost all swoops are warning swoops. They're not meant to make contact. They're meant, like your plover, stop short beforehand, you know. And some of the events that you hear in actual contact that has been made is quite often an accident. And some of that accident, sometimes those accidents get caused when a bike rider, for instance, turns around and suddenly the beak is in his face. Now, but that wasn't the intention of the bird.
Lots of people wanting to join us. Michael, firstly. Hello, Michael.
About magpies. Assessment of risk. I believe, and Giselle will confirm or deny this, they've got a recognition of about 200 metres of people.
Yep.
So they know whether you're a danger or whether you're not. Now, I've had a family coming here every year for about 3 years, until they've now obviously kicked the two young ones out, and there's now only the mother and father that come. And they come and sit within 40 centimetres of me, and she looks at the fridge saying, well, when am I getting my food? And I say to her, what? And she copies what I say.
So nesting is okay, and they know you, and so they feel fine, like what Gisella was just saying.
Yep, totally.
Yeah.
But that, she copies me when I say to her, well, what do you want, miss? I say, what? And she'll go, what?
Well, there was a funny situation. Magpies are extremely good mimics, and we always thought mimicking birds is just sort of parroting and stupid, and they don't know what they're doing and why. And we now know that in babies, the first stage is mimicking. It just depends whether you can apply that mimicked sound to a correct situation, you see. And I give to your caller, I give an answer in this property in New South Wales. There was a magpie, a cat and a dog on the magpie's territory, and the cat wanted the magpie out, and the magpie had learned the name of the dog and called the dog when the cat was approaching. The dog came close and chased the cat away, and the magpie stayed happily there. So obviously the calling of the dog is taking the mimicry one step further by using it in the right context, calling him and sorting out the cat.
Have you seen that funny ad on the TV with the two magpies sitting outside and saying, watch this, and they go and knock on the door? It's very funny, and make the person come to the door all the time. It's obviously they can do it. Melvin, good morning.
Good morning. Talk about magpies too. I've got pet magpies. I've got big gum trees in my backyard, and I just go to the back door and sing out Maggie, and they fly in for their, I feed them mints, and they bring their babies home. There's one that will take the meat out of my hand, and they've never, ever swooped.
And they're gentle?
Oh, beautiful. I take it, yes. They're beautiful birds. I just love them. And they know my voice. I go out, open the back door, and they'll fly in on at the back since they see the back door open.
Melvin, thank you. Gisella, earlier, I can't remember his name, mentioned that they have a 200-metre ability to be able to sort out, to know who it is. Is that right? Do they know who someone is from that distance?
Oh, certainly from that distance, they have very good eyesight. So 200 metres would be easy to do, yes, I would think so. But sometimes that might be just the contours, you see, of a person or the way they walk, because magpies have recognised me from behind, and I sometimes wonder how that was possible, because there have been studies done in face recognition in birds, but the whole posture thing is another interesting item, but they're very good. They don't forget, nor do Karawongs, actually. And that kind of individual recognition means they take note of who speaks to them. And once they are satisfied that it is not a risk, they're very capable, very much like dogs, to form long-standing friendships. And they're exceptionally good parents. And that's something that, by the way, birds have over mammals in birds, in Australian birds. Something like 95% of birds are paired up as diligent parents, and they bring up the children together very often in a cooperative way of totally shared duties, and they have very strict rules. I get so annoyed when a nature documentary says there are no rules in nature. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's not a free-for-all. And in fact, I think magpies are very strict parents. Mm. If a magpie youngster talks out of line, they will actually punish it.
Gisella, just on the idea, because we're talking to people who are saying that they feed the magpies, I've heard varying conflicting arguments on this, that you shouldn't feed native birds because they get too used to being fed. And that means that they don't go out and look for their own food. And I've heard people say that it's okay to feed them. What is it?
Well, it's all about amounts and type of food. And amounts, of course, if you feed birds and they derive most of their food from a person, and they will then, in fact, stop feeding, and they can show all sorts of malnutrition as a result, because let's say you feed one type of food, and in their natural environment they feed on lots of different food items, then they may miss out on vitamins, on trace elements and all of that, and generally become very malnourished. The other problem is if they're too dependent on the food, then let's say you're going on holidays for 4 weeks, the birds may actually starve, particularly if it's at a time when food availability is difficult. And but if you occasionally do a little bit of a feed in the morning of magpies, particularly if you have something like mints, there's no harm done, and they go away, and they need so much food in the day that they get all the things they want. But there was another interesting experiment that was conducted that showed that magpies know the value of food precisely, and they were given choices of food, including mincemeat and some worms, earthworms, and something else, crickets or something. And when the adults fed their own young, they chose the best food for their young, and they always took the mints to their offspring, and they ate the cricket, which of course has more husk and, than anything else, themselves. So they made a choice, and the best choices were for their offspring. I thought that was very remarkable too.
We'll go back to some more calls. Hello, Faye.
Hi, we had a patient sitting on the veranda and a magpie lark poked his eye. We had to send the patient to Townsville to get it fixed. But I was in a park once and all these bread was floating on the pond, and I threw my apple core in, and the duck, he grabbed that apple core and he took off, and these other ones chased after him. They know the difference.
Oh, it's true. And actually, when I was trying to think of birds that I think are scary, thank you, Faye, I reckon geese go down as the worst ones, Gisella.
Oh, geese are the best guard dogs.
Mm.
I'd risk a Muscovy Drake, and that's a very large bird when it's an adult. I didn't realise that when it was young. And that walked around the backyard, but it wouldn't allow anybody to enter.
A lot of people have geese as guarding, don't they?
Yes, and of course they make also a lot of noise, but this one was a particularly bad one. He flew onto the shoulder of people and started pummeling their necks.
Now you've just made me even scarier of geese. Swans are scary too, because swans, you don't just realise how big swans are.
Yes, swans are very big, and but swans can be very charming. My childhood experiences, my first bird in my life was a swan. The little pond I used to go to, I wasn't meant to, I was 3 years old, and I walked there by myself and sat down by the pond, and the swans came over and surrounded me and seemed to protect me. And it was always, I was always sitting in amongst swans.
Beautiful.
And yet other people came and they immediately attacked. So, and then many years later I learned that people were actually killing them for food. And so they had learned that these adults were dire enemies and had to be got rid of. And I obviously felt I was no, again, comes back to the risk assessment. And I felt very strangely how they surrounded me was as if they were protecting me. I mean, you know, with a three-year-old toddler.
Hmm.
And these huge birds next to me, and I felt very safe with them. So that's interesting, you see. One thing about the feeding, Trevor, if you're interested, there is a sad part to this. There are other intelligent birds like the wedge-tailed eagles, for instance. If you hand-raise a wedge-tailed eagle, get the wedge-tailed eagle used to people. They are as intelligent as dogs, and you can train them, and you can do all sorts of things, and they will walk with you, and only that you don't want this to happen. Because what happens, let's say, the bird that was humanized in this way and then released will go to picnic areas and insist on sharing the lunch. And there have been several eagles that had to be euthanized, unfortunately, because they insisted on their share. And insisting on their share in this case means that they have very big talons that they pull out and hold your arm down, and I can inflict serious injury. But this is only this is the result of mismanagement. Yeah.
They're beautiful birds. I've got a couple of texts here. Sean says, is it unusual for finches who are active overnight to be active overnight? Nobody should be this happy outside my window at midnight. And also, what's the difference between a finch and a wren?
Oh, they're completely different families. The only thing they have in common is they're both small.
Okay.
And the finches, all our finches that we have, particularly the zebra finches, are pairs, and they sometimes flock together. While the most common one, the superb blue wren that we have in this area, is one of the internationally famous cooperative species, with the very interesting little details, because they form these pairs and groups, and then the males go off and have these extramarital affairs, and the females go off and have a fling on the side. And then they all come back and still raise them, whoever the father or the mother was.
Well, they just have very open relationships. If you want to join us, 1-300-800-222. Text if you want to, 0437-7747.
What's the most you forked out for a concert ticket? Was it worth it?
Claire Bowditch.
Well, I told my kids that when Leonard Cohen came to town, I'd buy them all tickets, all their partners' tickets.
Do you have a figure?
I think it was about $3,000.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was the best money I've ever spent in my entire life. It was all magic.
I hope they got it, Lionel.
I hope so.
Claire Bowditch, Monday to Thursday from 2 on ABC Radio Victoria.
AU.
Gisella Kaplan is my guest, Professor of Animal Behaviour at the University of New England. If you want to join us, 1-300-800-222. Terry, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Trevor?
Good, Terry.
That's good. I'm still awake, so I thought I'd ring and tell you a story.
Yeah.
But I'll keep it brief. In the early 80s, I lived in Mission Beach in North Queensland, and we had a male casuary with three of his chicks in our backyard. And we fed him some bananas, and they went sideways down his throat.
Yeah.
So you could actually see the bananas as they were going down. And it was just beautiful. It was really, really beautiful. There was no injuries, and then we didn't get too close, but close enough to feed him bananas.
But it's just an idea of respecting the animal, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And last summer, I was I live in Perth, Western Australia, and I was in I live in the city, and I was just parked at a set of traffic lights, and a flock of these beautiful white parrots that you see, anyway, making a lot of noise, and they were starting to perch for the night. It was going on sunset, and there was, because I was at a set of traffic lights, I was noticing this bloke on a motorbike who was in their way, and they covered him. They literally covered this bloke on the motorbike. Luckily, he sort of drove off, or he rode off, but it was kind of funny but horrifying at the same time.
But that does sound like something out of The Birds.
Yeah, I went to see that. We had a festival here not long ago, and for 3 days, every time I looked at crows, and I love crows, I couldn't look at crows.
Oh, you couldn't look at any bird after that film.
Oh, it was a great movie, seeing it on the big screen again.
Even finches came out of that badly. Thank you. Gisella, a question. Do plovers have poisonous spurs on their wings?
Do which?
Plovers.
Plovers, yes.
So all of them, all plovers, or just certain different plovers?
Oh, I think it's only one species, but and it's very vestigial, so it's nothing really to worry about, although handling can injure you, but it doesn't do any harm. You just need to know what to do.
Are they actually called spurwing plovers?
Yeah, they can be, yes. They're different sort of popular names for the four-masked lapwings, yes.
Like, I've got a whole new appreciation for them now, Gisella. I don't mind that one having a go at me as long as it doesn't hit me. Lorna, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Look, I've got two stories. One about cassowaries. This happened about 30 years back. A family, mother, father, and two young teenage children were in a rainforest area behind Cairns, North Queensland, and came upon a cassowary who was a little bit, I call them who, like I love birds, you know, and it was a little bit aggressive, but this family had fruit, and somebody dropped an apple on the ground, and that gave them a safe escape because they are fruit eaters. And that's how they got away from the cassowary. And by the way, they grow to the height of 1.5 metres, which is large. And then my other story is butcher birds. They are becoming affected or dying off by pollution. And we were having lunch on our front veranda one day, and one lone butcher bird came and sat on my arm. I didn't invite him. He just did it because he wanted company. And we were all surprised, including me. But birds can pick up attitude of people.
Oh, is that right, Gisella? Can they pick up if you've got a bad attitude?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's bad attitude they can pick up, but they can certainly pick up body language and movement, and they also respond adversely to noise, because that's very often part of an aggressive display in other species. So in a way, they read from all these signs, you know, the visible signs, and when people are nice and quiet and go about their business, they probably assess correctly that that person isn't a danger.
I've got a text here from Dan that says, "Hi, Trevor, I often see adult magpies' parents pecking at the younger magpies that appear to be playing dead or lying on their back, and then they suddenly get up like nothing has happened. Why are they doing this?"
Oh, that's a good question. The as I said before, you know, magpie parents are very fair, very caring, but also very strict. And if, let's say, a youngster gets a bit cocky and discovers a food item and takes it before dad can have a go at it, that is definitely not advisable. And the father or the adult male will, in fact, then say, "Look here, this is once only." And then the youngster, very much like dogs, goes into a submissive stage, and that's on the back. That's the most submissive posture, just as dogs do. And the adult then has to decide whether it's still going to peck it as a punishment and a warning, or whether that's sufficient apology.
I like that. Cara, good morning.
Gisella, I just wanted to talk to you. For the last 5 years, I'm in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales.
Yes.
I've had
I've been blessed to have a family of blue wrens, little superb wrens, nesting in my backyard. I don't have any small bushes in my backyard at all. I have very untidy, unkempt, thick grass, which I leave that way. It's very, very thick, and they actually build their nests in there. And it's beautiful to see when the babies are raised, and it's wonderful. On these cold mornings that we're having up here, they're jumping, the mother and father, because there's no babies yet this year, but jumping in and out of the bird bath in the freezing cold water, eating the grated cheese that I put out for them. And they delight me, and I feel really blessed to have them, and it's wonderful.
Well, the point is they're also very useful for your garden, and they take away all the creepy crawlies that you don't like. Something like aphids, for instance, for rose lovers, don't spray roses, leave it to the birds because they're doing a better job, and that you don't need to put poisons out. But they also need something like 2.5 acres for one family. And obviously they have enough of a background there, so you're very lucky to have a whole family there.
Text here from Stumpy that says, why does my female budgie push and crack her eggs open when there's a male budgie with her? Is there any way to stop it?
That's sometimes in captivity that happens, unfortunately, that they're prepared to have sex but not prepared to have offspring. So there you are, and the only good way is to give them, put them in a larger aviary, to give them a different environment or escape mechanism. But some females, this is even more complicated, Trevor. It's just been discovered that parrots develop, and even as small as the budgerigar, develop distinct likes and dislikes. They may prefer one partner over another.
Mm.
And they will do well with one partner and not reproduce with another. So sometimes, you know, we assume that animals don't care who they're mating with, but they do.
I've got a text that says, we live on a property in central Victoria and have had some chickens disappear with only feathers left. Can an owl take a chicken?
Can what, sorry?
Can an owl take a chicken?
Yes.
And do they?
Well, I'm not so sure whether owls do, but certainly goshawks do on a regular basis.
Okay, there we go.
So, and goshawks are ambush hunters and very sneaky, and I would protect any chicken from goshawks because it's an awful death.
When you say sneaky, is it just that they're good hunters?
No, well, they're ambush hunters.
Okay.
They really, you cannot watch them. I've actually watched attacks on magpie juveniles, and I didn't see the goshawk. The magpie mother saw it and intervened, but this whole event was less than 10 seconds. The goshawk came out, shot straight for the magpie youngster, and the mother intercepted all within the context of 10 seconds. So they're extremely fast.
Peter, good morning.
The birds, it's not the it's the birds that have disappeared since I've been a young person, and the different different ways they've nested. Sparrows always nested in trees mainly nested in trees when I was young. You never see a sparrow nest in trees anymore. A crow, I know I'm babbling on like a brook now. Crows, when they're not under stress, will walk, and when they're under pressure, hop. Which is again normally their brain is birds that hop have a single sided brain, and vice versa. The disappearance of owls and. In my area, I've got old buildings, always had owl droppings and what have you. They're all gone. The lack of insects for these birds to eat is unbelievable.
Peter, let me go to Gisela. There's a couple of things. Firstly, are we losing owls because of a loss of environment, loss of trees?
Well, not so much that, but actually they need enormous area and they need the prey items. So if you take some owl that needs something like 600 grams in a day, and or if even just 400 grams a day, a mouse weighs only 25 grams. So you can imagine how much food there needs to be available. And the more built up an area is, and the more we get what is known in ecology as impervious floors, meaning, you know, it's all bitumen and concreted up, the less the food availability becomes. So there's a whole range of things that have happened with urbanisation that have forced the owls further out, reduced the number of small mammals, and in some cases even reduced the insects. But most of the insect problems are related to climate change, that insects appear too late or are drowned if larvae are underground, or they don't get enough water, whatever the case may be, or it gets too hot in summer. But there are times, as it has been now, that birds have started nesting far too early and there are no insects out. So the result is that they won't have enough food for their offspring.
Good morning, Ian.
Yeah, good morning, Trevor. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I saw a little quick documentary on a neighbour's TV. A baby bird hatched out of its egg and it immediately, once born, pushed the other eggs out of the nest. What kind of bird was that?
That sounds very much like a cuckoo.
I think that might have been what it was, yes.
Because some of the cuckoo species, that is the very first job they do, and they do that with their behinds. They, not with their heads, but they push it out with their backs, so that they are the only ones. And then they vocalise in a way that somehow makes the sound of several of their own offspring. So the vocal sound they make is very is an imitation, as if they had a clutch of four.
Gisella, we were talking about cuckoos briefly on the program yesterday. Do they pick on any type of bird?
Oh, no. There's got to be a size relationship between that. And the Channelbird cuckoo is the largest cuckoo we have in Australia. It is, I believe, the largest cuckoo in the world. It's huge. I don't know whether you've ever seen one. It's got a massive bill. It's actually a fruit eater, and they're migratory. So we don't have any of them in winter, but they come to New South Wales in summer, and so do the common coels. Coels spelled K-O-E-L. And both of them are fruit eaters. And then they put their eggs, preferably because they're such large birds, into those of magpies and currawongs. And the incredible thing is the Channelbird cuckoo sounds in its begging calls very much like a mixture between a currawong fledgling and a magpie fledgling. So it's imitating that sound. And nastily, when the poor magpies have raised this huge bird, the parents hover around, call the bird, and then disappear with it and introduce it to the world of fruit.
Geez, they're horrible things, aren't they? You don't like them, do you?
I feel sorry for the magpies and the currawongs, but at the same time, you must admit, it's the most ingenious method of childcare.
Budgie, good morning.
Yeah, hi Trevor. Wonderful program. I'm an absolute magpie maniac.
Yeah.
And it started many years ago. I'm 86. And when I was 30, a magpie used to wait for me to come home on my little Beezer Bantam motorbike. And I had a big mop of blonde, silky hair. And this magpie used to land on my head, hang on with his claws as I rode up the side of the house. And he'd reach over and pull on my eyelashes with his beak and poke his beak up my ear or up my nose as I rode up beside the house. And when I stopped and got off the bike, he'd land on my shoe and hang on and undo my shoelace. And he was quite an amazing bird. All the kids around here used to chuck stones at him and he used to attack them. But for some reason, he took to me.
Well, that's because you were nice to him, Budgie.
And I've had magpie mates all this time for 60 years and they land on my handlebars on my bike and things like that. And they're the most wonderful bird, I think. Very, very clever.
Budgie, thank you. Gisella, that's the sort of attitude we want, isn't it?
It's based on observation and interaction. So, you know, the more you know about something and the more you interact with them, the more you get to know them and see that whatever mythology develops around danger and so forth is just made up and is taking an incident out totally out of context and proportion. So, and the interesting remark in this was, it's a fantastic statement of love of this bird for it to preen and do all this thing around his ears and eyes and Lord knows what, and that's a sign of affection. And the other, it shows that the bike in itself is not a feared object for the magpies. It was always assumed that it was, you know, the bike that did it and caused the swooping. No, they knew him and they appreciated him, and it didn't matter whether he was on a bike or not.
Bernie, good morning.
I've got a bit of a story about emus, you know.
Yeah.
We had I'm coming from Glen Ellerdale to Stratford and Gippsland, and I'm going around the scrub in the car. And unfortunately, when I come around the corner, I hit an emu. And he's lying in front of the car, and I get out, and the dog gets out, and we're looking at it. And then all of a sudden, his mate turns up, and he's pouncing around the car, and I said to the dog, get back in the car. And he was attacking me. Because I heard his mate. You still there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
And then there was in those days when we didn't have a mobile phone. So every time I get out of the car, this emu comes back and it's pouncing and attacking. And we had to wait till another car came an hour and a half later to go back to Stratford and get a tow truck. And this guy was still around, pouncing around the car.
Gisella, is that something that that emus or other birds will do, and that they will protect their mates?
Oh yes, most definitely. And in some cases, that's the kind of relationship between birds can be such that if one gets killed, the other one guards it and will eventually die. Can birds feel grief? I said, I have no idea. But frankly, I've seen this in tawny frogmouths. If it guarded the dead mate, it was hit by a car, and it died 4 days later in the same spot. It never moved. So, and it made these weird little whining noises. It was absolutely heartbreaking to watch. So in itself, it's not an aggressive action, but it can also be somehow to bring back the mate. So there are very strong bonds, and we often underestimate them when we think we can just, you know, this is why I object to shooting birds, and even if they're game birds, because you don't know whom you take out. You may take out somebody's partner of 10 years or what have you, you see. So it's heartbreaking when you see that. But that story of the emu is quite a remarkable one.
This is one of the things I love about talking to you, Gisella, is that we're learning things about birds that we just did not know, and it gives us a different perspective so that, as you said earlier, so that we understand what birds are going through, that they grieve, that they look after partners, that they're loyal, that there are all of these things that we don't necessarily consider.
Yeah. And some of them have extramarital affairs, and they have divorces, and they have all sorts of things that are very reminiscent of human society. And the more we get to know about them, and it's not anthropomorphizing, it's that we know that they stay together, and we know that they raise their offspring together, and we know that they have squabbles, and we know that some get on better than others with each other. But the new element is that they actually grieve for the loss of a partner. And that's a new profound knowledge that's only a few years old, really.
And good morning.
I live just outside of Melbourne and semi in a suburb, and I've got these tiny little birds. They're smaller than your little finger, and they flit so fast, I can't get a good look at them. And they have the most beautiful song. What are they?
Well, it's likely that they may be even the spinebill, a little honey eater. There's a little honey eater, the eastern spinebill, that has an enormously strong voice and beautiful song. Very well outside its size, and so has a little brown honey eater, which is literally the size of your small finger. And but then there are also the weebills. But the weebill is the smallest bird in Australia, and there are some thornbills which are called that's your LBJ, little brown jobs, when you can't identify them because they flit past so quickly. But thornbills too have a beautiful song. And it may be worth listening to that, and that may give you the identification. But the songbirds are totally underrated in Australia. They are as good and better than the birds that have been described, you know, the mockingbirds, the nightingales and all of that. They're every bit as good here. And for such little birds, that's quite remarkable.
I didn't even know you could, the size of your little finger, it's a tiny bird.
It's a very tiny bird. It's 9 centimetres long. So I don't know how long your little finger is, Trevor. We have to measure this now, whether the little finger analogy works.
Auntie B, good morning.
My daughter, many years ago, had a pet crow. And when when we got him first, we didn't have a very good fence he could get out. And I was worried he'd get hurt by the traffic. So I went out and waited for him. And when he came out, I growled at him, said not to come out. And he never went out again. And he was so clever. I'm sure he thought we were his family. And he'd go out and get out up the tree out the front every night and wait until my daughter was coming home from school. Soon as she came round the corner, he'd say, ah, every night at 4:15. And one day, our little dog had a bone on the back of our lawn, and the crow wanted the bone. And you could see him thinking, and he went over to a tin that I had pegs in, and he took a peg out of the tin, and he had one eye on the dog, and he was throwing the peg up and down, up and down, up and down, until the dog got interested, left his bone and went up to see what was happening. And the crow just went off with the bone immediately.
They're far too clever, Gisella.
Yes, well, you'll be interested to know that ravens and the cockatoos and the budgerigar have the largest brain relative to their body size of all Australian birds and worldwide. So they are very clever, and they are so clever that they like children and can also use that for deception, and very clever deception. Dogs do that too.
Terry will be our last caller. Good morning, Terry.
How are you, mate? Lovely show, Trev.
Thank you. Oh, it's not me, it's Gisella.
We've been feeding magpies for about 10 or 12 years. They are so friendly bird, you can't believe it. They sit on your shoulder, sit on your arm. There's only one rule in that little family. You must feed the male first. Once you feed him, there's no problems with the rest of them, but he likes to be fed. He will even come into the kitchen of the house to get his meat first, and they're just so friendly. They really are. No swooping in the area. Nobody has an issue with the birds swooping through breeding time. So, like you've said before, it's just a matter of understanding and living with them, and they're a great pet. They really are.
Thank you. Just on that, thank you very much, Terry. Gisella, when we say pets, are they really a pet, or are they just tolerating us, or there's a relationship?
Oh, there is definitely a relationship, and where you know that there's a relationship when they bring the youngsters to the back porch for introduction purposes. So, and they're very respectful. You see, one of the reasons why magpies get killed on roads and ravens don't is magpies expect their territory to be respected. And that means the car should slow down and not ask them to leave when it's their territory while the others are passing through. There's a whole logic to a magpie behavior. But if they have found a group of people who are nice, they are genuinely friendly, but I would never have them as a pet because they have to form their own territories and it has to be of their own making. And when it's a good territory, they will stay for the rest of their life. And that can be 20, 25 years. So there can be very intimate friendships formed between people and magpies. And they'll be very faithful and very useful because they warn everybody else about birds of prey. They warn about intruders of any kind. And they will act on it as well. So.
And they'll clean your ears out.
Very rarely, actually.
Graham called and wanted to know if there are less sparrows around than there used to be, especially around the Sydney region.
Well, there are fewer bird species around. There have been good studies now to say that at least 40% of birds disappear and from city areas, unless you live in an urban fringe that still abuts to some open country. And some of them are really afraid of people and afraid or just don't find enough or the noise levels are too high, and others have adapted quite well. So, but there's definitely a loss of species, while some have comfortably adapted to it and found nesting spots in roof houses and windowsills and so forth.
So just quickly, I've got a text here that says, I used to see a brown and white magpie. Could this have been an albino magpie?
No, we do get some colour variation, and that is not really explained well. Yes, there are albinos, but the brown variation usually isn't, well, perhaps it has some elements of it, but it wouldn't be classified an albino. But we do have very odd brownish tones occurring occasionally, and one wonders whether there are environmental factors and pesticides involved which have caused that in the first place. Because I tend not to live that long.
Gisela, it's always wonderful talking to you on the radio. Thank you very much.
Well, lovely to talk to you, Trevor, as always.
Gisela Kaplan, she's a professional animal behaviourist at the University of New England, also the author of Australian Magpie Biology and Behaviour of an Unusual Songbird.